From the newsroom of Impact Alpha, I'm Monique Aiken, and this is your Impact Briefing for Friday, April 21st. Today, I'm joined by Diane Dillon Ridgely, Board Chair of the Intentional Endowments Network, to talk about the U.S. financial regulatory landscape, climate change, and transforming financial systems. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
But first, here's what you need to know from the week in impact investing. This was Climate Week in San Francisco, and just in time for Earth Day, Impact Alpha launched its newest climate finance tracker. The Climate Co-Investor Tracker, in collaboration with Vibrant Data Labs and Second Muse, tracks relationships among venture investors, philanthropists, and others. That ecosystem is making climate investment more resilient in the face of risks, such as the recent collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and the broader venture capital pullback. The tracker also makes clear the role of catalytic capital, especially in the form of government grants for clean tech innovation. More than 96% of climate tech VCs are just 2 degrees of separation from at least one government grant. Check it out at impactalpha.com/CFT. China manufactures more batteries than the rest of the world combined and is responsible for nearly half of the world's total spending on solar, wind, electric vehicles, and other low-carbon technologies. Yet for all its ambitions in green energy and its embrace of ESG investing, China has frustrated expectations of a bigger market for private impact investing. Impact Alpha contributing editor Dan Keeler dug into the obstacles to the development of an impact ecosystem in China. Here's a trend to watch: embedded finance. It's the practice of adding financing to warehouses and logistics, enterprise software, and other business services, especially in emerging markets. MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth is investing $15 million in Acción to stake out inclusive embedded finance. Jessica Pothering has an in-depth Q&A. And finally, in our continuing effort to make boring municipal bonds cool and actionable, we're highlighting the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency's $150 million social bond, which is expected to come to market by May 4th. Proceeds will help homebuyers with less than 80% of the area median income. The bond is featured as part of Impact Alpha's collaboration with HIP Investor, which is identifying upcoming issuances with social and/or environmental significance. Before we turn to my guest today, here's a quick update from the president of the U.S. Impact Investing Alliance, Fran Siegel, about SEC Chief Gary Gensler's testimony before Congress this week regarding the regulators' proposed climate disclosure rules.
There are many steadfast champions for the corporate disclosure and transparency agenda among key congressional leaders. Ranking Member Maxine Waters opened with a strong assertion that the SEC's corporate climate disclosure rule will, quote, finally provide the material information that investors have been asking for. Representative Sean Casten emphasized the real material risks of climate issues for investors. And Chair Gensler doubled down on these sentiments throughout, emphasizing that the SEC is, of course, not a climate regulator, but it is in the business of ensuring investors have the information they need to make sound investment decisions. Others, like Representative Ayanna Pressley, brought it back to the human impact of climate risks, imploring that we, quote, put people over polluters. Many in our field tuned into the hearing out of concern that it would devolve into a debate on ESG. And fortunately, for the most part, the debate among members stayed above the fray. That's not to say that the SEC won't face an uphill battle as it moves to finalize the corporate climate disclosure rule, finalize the ESG funds labeling rule, and propose human capital management or workforce disclosures. The impact investing community must continue to rally to demonstrate the widespread support for these long overdue and common sense updates that bring our securities regulations into the 21st century.
My guest today is Diane Dillon Ridgely, who for over 4 decades has been an environmentalist and human rights activist. She is chair of the board of the Intentional Endowments Network, chair of the board at the Center for International Environmental Law, co-chair of the Green Leadership Trust, and board member of the Vermont Energy Investment Corporation. She stays busy. Diane, thank you for joining me in person today.
Thanks.
So let's get started. The regulatory policy political environment is the canvas on which we all paint as investors. Can you share your perspective on what's going on these days and in the U.S. and around the world and your view on it?
I'd like to. I only laugh because it just seems here we are in 2023, and maybe it's because I have a significant, although there are no insignificant birthdays at this point, but I have a significant birthday next week. And it just seems like at this point, we shouldn't be going over things that we thought we had covered, that we thought had moved forward. And it almost at some moments at 3 o'clock in the morning, it feels like we're going back as much as we're going forward. I mean, why are we arguing over the debt ceiling? You know, this should be so things that are just so obvious and so plain. I do get frustrated, but I try and couch that frustration and channel it into being able to link together where we have made progress. I mean, there's some basic things that we know: more disclosure, more transparency. This is essential for us to really preserve and improve our democracy.
Let's go to climate change, which is your professional domain. You've been a lifelong environmental and human rights activist. Can you share your view on where we are on climate change and your prognosis for our 2-degree goal, to your point about going backwards?
Well, I happen to have been a White House delegate to the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992. And on good days, I look at what was put together in the IRA inside this current Biden administration. And technically, it is, in fact, the most significant actual policy recommendations and pieces that we've had today. Enough? Not even close. I mean, I also look at what we put forward in 1992 at the global level and domestically. That was the tee off for when Clinton was elected to have the President's Council on Sustainable Development. I was one of 25 appointees to that. We had 5 cabinet secretaries. That's 28 years ago. We put in place, we proposed specific recommendations, and not all just at the national government level, but the kinds of things that we needed to do in our churches, in our communities, in our organizations, in our schools. And it seemed like we were starting to make a momentum on that. And then all of a sudden, somebody said, well, you're changing everything we're doing. Well, of course, because if we weren't in crisis, if we weren't on the threshold of failure, I mean, I always describe it. I know people want to say climate change, and that turns some people off, and I understand that. I said, so let's identify the problem. We currently have failed at living sustainably on Earth. Now, that actually is harsh. I think that's more harsh, but that's a reality of what it is. What we have done or failed to do with our forest, what we have added and put in our environment without understanding the implications of coming together, the threats to ecosystems, to extinctions. I mean, to the reduction of wildlife. Right now, 80% of the mammals on this planet are either humans, pets, or livestock. 100 years ago, that number was somewhere closer to 30%. We've had these cumulative impacts and changes that have resulted from decisions that were done piecemeal without looking at the long-term implications of what we were doing, who was impacted, and how and where.
We have to zoom out. We have to plan for the long term. And so, from your vantage point, you have sat on public company boards, you chair the board of the Intentional Endowments Network, you've served in governance roles in many philanthropic organizations, including the Wallace Global Fund, and you've served in 23 U.S. government delegations to the UN. There's a significant role that the financial industry in specific has played in how we got here, these multiple intersecting crises like that you've just described: climate, COVID, inequality, police brutality, and the rest. And so the role that investors and other actors in the financial system need to play to shore up systems that you just described, democratic systems in addition, and indeed every industry must do to play its part, because all these systems are interconnected. But we have talked about, you and I, strategies that and practices that got us here won't get us out of these crises. New tools and innovation will be required. What have you seen emerge that might be able to help move us forward on these climate inequity crises?
Well, I was thinking back to a TED talk I gave about 10 years ago, and I built on it. I was at Auburn University. I built on it from 2003. And I remember very clearly saying, this century has got to be the justice century. And where I am actually encouraged is, you know, 30, 40 years ago, the financial industry kept saying, well, we don't have anything to do with the environment. Well, I said, it's really unfortunate. We've spent the last 45 years politicizing the environment instead of what we should have done was to environmentalize politics. Mm-hmm. Because you are never not in an environment. So the environment can't just be another subject or another issue that we on which we bring to bear and make decisions. It has to be understood that it is inside the nature of literally the nature of everything we're doing. And I mean, and I often would say and learned when I was in undergraduate school, I went to Howard, in undergraduate school, that we have finally, because of the increase in population, there's a really clear prediction that within the next 5 to 10 years, we may tap over 9 billion people. When I was born, and I'm not that old, when I was born, you know, we were closer to 2 billion people on Earth. So looking at that level of increase, we used to have what I would always call the natural sink capacity. The Ogallala Aquifer could recharge itself, but the draws that we've made on it now, it can't keep up with that. Look, for the first time ever, what we had with the Hoover Dam and the water levels. I mean, people are seeing things that had been underwater for decades. So I think it is stunning and somewhat overwhelming to many of the policy people and those who are in decision makers who are in roles of responsibility to making decisions. But I mean, the Colorado River could well run dry. Things that would have just been absolutely fundamentally unthinkable. We've changed air flows. And I mean, I could go on and list it. And actually, I get frustrated when people just list the technical problems. But I am actually encouraged. I must be encouraged. And I'm encouraged because there has been, at least more intensely in the last 10 years, a recognition on the part of the financial industry writ large, the role and responsibility that it has in lending. Decisions are not just money decisions about lending. They're also decisions about that have bring to bear on natural resources. Making a decision about whether or not we're going to have more electricity produced by coal, never mind the toxins and other things that get released in that, but just period, or whether we're going to invest more in renewables like wind and solar. And then we decisions that make real the understanding that we have oversubsidized the fossil fuel industry. And while some people want to say that the nuclear industry is free, well, you have to include all of the process because you have to mine the uranium and the source materials. And then we as humans have never kept anything consciously safe and buried for 5,000 years because the shelf life of spent uranium and materials is longer than anything else that humans have ever controlled. So we need some we need some humility when we come to making some of these decisions. And we need a lot more of the kinds of things that my grandmothers and grandmothers talked about, of realizing that we are not, I mean, well, yes, okay, we're not God, obviously, but we also need to be, we really need to be not so much modest, but humble may not be quite the right word. I'm not sure what, in fact, I have a whole thought about our language. Sometimes the legal infrastructure that we have in place traps us into making decisions in ways that have, that lead us to more problems. And, you know, the old adage is when you're in a hole, stop digging is the very first thing that you should do. But we're doubling down sometimes instead of pulling back and stepping back. I do also have a lot of hope from young people. Some of it is born out of the frustration and the clarity that they have around, I know it's inappropriate to only use Greta Thunberg, because as wonderful and as consistent as she has been, one, she doesn't want this role. And I am an African-American woman, and I have seen so many times when we have let the lens inspector of race and race decision make us think that only certain people do it. There was a picture with Greta, was in a picture with four or five other young people from other places, but the only one who got named and the only one who was talked about, the young woman from Uganda, no.
Vanessa Nakate.
Yes, thank you. Yes. And so, you know, we've got to realize that we are all in this. Now, this also, this past year, at the UN level, the right to a healthy environment, we do it R2HE, was passed. 160 countries complied with it. What was powerful about that also was that it was the first time we've had an equal intellectual and political input from the, I don't call countries developed countries and undeveloped countries, because right now every country is developing when it comes to sustainability mm-hmm. and figuring out how to live safely on Earth. But the small island states, all who are some of the front line
yeah.
in terms of vulnerability, all of the states came together to say, and some people use the global North and the global South, whatever metaphor or framing you might want to use, this literally is, it's not just that it's global, it's everyone. And fundamental levels of equality must be understood and embraced. And that's why I'd say, if we begin by thinking this as the justice century, and we center justice as the core of what we use as our frame, I think we will make decisions that will honor and respect the Kayapo Indians in South America, as well as the Ogoni people in Nigeria and in Africa, as well as the Sami people in northern Norway, and I'm going to try and pick some other people, but you get the point.
Yeah.
There are people with indigenous knowledge that has been profound, that has allowed them to farm and have agriculture in places for thousands and thousands of years. The Industrial Revolution is kind of pretty much spun out in 200 years. Mm-hmm. It's made amazing changes in terms of the way we live, but these changes have come at a high cost.
And those are the costs we call externalities in finance. And externalities, and certainly earlier this week at the gathering that we had on Tuesday, Bill talked about, Bill Burkhart from the Investment Integration Project, where I work by day, talked about externality denying capitalism, which basically means consequence denying. And what does that mean? We need these new tools, because what got us here
is not sufficient.
Is not going to get us.
We can quote we can quote Einstein on that. Or another one I like lately, this past couple of weeks, I've been using Faulkner. It said the past, it isn't even past, you know? So we're literally carrying trauma and holding all of this at once. And it is overwhelming. And I do understand that. I speak at a lot of religious institutions, whether it's at a synagogue, a temple, or a church, and you know, you look at people's eyes and I try to make a message that isn't frightening or creates fear, but it is tremendous. And if I do believe we still have the capacity to address these things. But even if we didn't, we still have the task, unless we're just going to give up and let's say, we'll just have a big party. It's going to last for the next 40 years, probably. It's like spinning down everything. But we are technically right now spending down our base capital. Well, we know better. There's so much in the ways that we know better to do than what we are doing. There is wisdom and richness of thought and potential for solutions. And we clearly don't know where the solutions are going to come from. So let's have at the party, at the table, a wide enough range that we give the most rich, vibrant opportunity for our decisions to come.
We need the innovation in the who and the how and the what and the next next 21st century for us to be able to move forward and actually do something and actually potentially have a chance for the hopefulness that you just described. Well, I think we should leave it there. And thank you so much for joining me, Diane.
Well, it went so fast, and of course I knew it would. Thank you so much for asking me. I look forward to maybe coming back. And I know some other people. They would be wonderful at bringing to you more of the rich opportunity that we have, but also the responsibility.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's going to do it for this week's Impact Briefing. Thanks to Diane, Fran, and our producer, Isaac Silk. Ready to try Impact Alpha? Sign up for Impact Alpha Open, free of charge, directly at impactalpha.com. Want to go deeper? Grab a subscription and get full access to the site, Agents of Impact calls, and the daily email brief. Just go to impactalpha.com/subscribe and choose an annual subscription. Thank you for listening. I'm Anik Agin, Managing Director for TIP, the Investment Integration Project. Be sure to check back for next week's briefing, and until then, take care.